Hello and welcome to the Mr. Brown podcast, where I reflect on my journey as an early career teacher, with a special focus on mental health. I am your host, James Brown. Good morning. Just a quick check-in today, as I'm feeling rather pooped. I've done several strike episodes recently, and in fact, the strike on Wednesday, I think, is probably why I'm feeling rather pooped. A lot of teachers on Twitter seem to appreciate having the day's break in the middle of the week if they were striking, whereas I found it all quite tiring. It was a great day insofar as I felt I learnt a lot. I think that on balance, I made the right decision at the time, and I still feel it was the right decision, but I'll continue to weigh the pros and cons of future strike action for any future decisions. But I feel it was the right thing to do at the time, and I learnt a great deal, and learning's always tiring. Ask any of your students. And the break of routine, I think I also found rather tiring, and also just being outside for ages. So yes, rather tired, and I haven't quite yet recovered. That said, I often say I'm only going to do a quick episode today, and then I end up rambling for hours. So we'll see what happens. The first thing I wanted to ask you today is whether it's okay to dislike a student. So I have a particular student of mine in mind. He regularly shouts out. He regularly disrupts the lesson. He refuses to acknowledge when he's done something wrong. And when I say refuses to acknowledge, he will just refuse, outright refuse. I could have him in for a half an hour detention at lunchtime. I could talk to him for that full half an hour and bring all my reasoning skills to bear on that conversation, and he won't budge an inch. And he talks with a bit of an attitude. I'm sure we've all had similar students, and I found myself, or I spotted myself, starting to dislike this student. But I think it's important for me as a teacher not to dislike any of my students. Now, I threw this question out on Twitter, and some teachers seemed to think it was okay to dislike students. It's a perfectly natural thing to happen, as long as you don't let it affect your teaching. But I think that must be a very difficult or even impossible task. We've all heard about how implicit biases and prejudices can affect the way we behave. And so if I dislike a student, no matter how professional I try to be, it's bound to affect my teaching and my interactions with him. And I did spot this starting to happen, so I would just be a little less patient with this student than I was with other students. And I think that was because he was indeed irritating me and I was starting to dislike him. And so for me, I think rather than allow myself to dislike him and then try to not let it affect me as a teacher, as his teacher, instead I've tried to stop disliking him altogether. I've tried to understand why he might be the way he is. And I've also tried to focus on everything he does right and to heap praise on him where I can. And that has started to shift my mindset towards him. And I wouldn't say I dislike him anymore. I spotted myself starting to dislike him, but I managed to stop that in its tracks. And I wouldn't say now he's one of my favourite students, but I wouldn't say I dislike him. And I think that's better. I think that's a better approach than allowing myself to dislike him and then trying to not let that dislike affect how I act as a teacher. But I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on that one. Do you dislike any of your students? If so, how do you prevent that from affecting your work as a teacher? The second thing I'd like to talk about today is competition and motivation. So competition is often used in classrooms as a way to motivate students. And I have found myself using it a few times recently, but I think it has to be used very carefully. So I used it once, and I think I used it badly. It was in a computer science lesson. The students had to decode some binary. There was a message that was written in binary, ones and zeros, and they had to use a key to figure out what the message was. And I said, the first student, or the first few students, I think, to decode the message can get a load of points. Okay, we have a point system at our school. This seemed to really motivate a small minority of students who really believed that they could be the ones to do it first, and yet demotivate everyone else who thought, well, I'm never going to beat so-and-so, so why should I bother at all? I think that was a bad use of competition. So I think it's important when using competition that each and every student in the class feels like they could potentially win the competition. And how might you achieve this? Well, we sometimes do a STARS activity in maths where students complete questions on a worksheet. Each question is worth a certain number of stars, and once they've completed it, they get the stars, and then the students at the end with the most stars wins. Now, they do this STARS competition in pairs, and I did it once with my Year 7 class last year, where I paired the stronger students with the weaker students, so kind of leveled the playing field. So each pair had about the same chance of winning the competition because each pair had a stronger student and a weaker student. It was a bit of a nightmare with my Year 7s last year because the weaker students, well, they didn't know I was doing this. I didn't say I'm going to pair strong students with weak students. I just did it. But they all dug their heels in because they wanted to pair up with their friends rather than with who I wanted them to pair up with. So that was an issue. But I think the principle is sound. And recently, my Year 7s did a spiral assessment, and they're bonkers for raffle tickets. I don't entirely understand what's going on with these raffle tickets in the year group at the moment, but there's clearly some sort of ongoing raffle competition, and they all want to win it, and there must be some good prizes. So anyway, Year 7 teachers were given handfuls of raffle tickets to give out to exceptionally good students, and so I thought I would try to motivate, or at least give my students a little extra motivation for this spiral assessment using these raffle tickets. Now, I got them in, sat them down. Before they started the spiral, I explained to them that the reason we study maths is because it's good to be good at maths. And I think I said that three times. But then I said, I was happy to give them an extra little incentive on top of the main reason, which we study maths, because it's good to be good at maths. The extra little incentive was these raffle tickets. I said I'd award 5 raffle tickets each to the 5 students who make the most progress on the spiral assessment compared with their previous unit assessment marks. So I keep a rolling average of each student's unit assessment marks. I think that's quite useful data to have. And so I would compare their new spiral assessment mark with their rolling average, and the students who made the most progress would get these raffle tickets. So that meant that those raffle tickets, as that extra little incentive, were up for grabs by anyone in the room. Well, not really, although I didn't explain this to them. I said that everyone has got an equal chance of winning these raffle tickets, which wasn't really true. In fact, it disadvantaged the really good students because some students have been getting very high marks all year. And so they didn't really have much room to make more progress. It was the students lower down who had a lot of room in which to progress in this particular spiral. But in the end, actually, the 5 students who did make the most progress, it was quite a good mix between the higher attainers and the lower attainers in that group. But it's really nice because now on Monday, when I give them their results and I can award these raffle tickets, some students who don't ordinarily win anything, they're going to be getting raffle tickets, which is really nice because they made lots of progress. One student's spiral assessment result was 80% higher than their rolling average. Absolutely insane. So I think that was an example of using competition quite well. Now, in terms of self-determination theory, which is my favourite theory on motivation, and indeed the best theory on motivation, and by best I mean most comprehensive and most corroborated in terms of empirical studies. It stood the test of time, this one. According to self-determination theory, being well motivated to do something depends on your feelings of autonomy, competence, and also belonging. And so, according to my big book on self-determination theory, competition can be good as long as it doesn't undermine autonomy or competence. So in the earlier bad example of using competition, where most of the class felt they couldn't win the competition, that would have undermined competence. Those kids would have felt like they weren't really good enough to win the competition, and that would have been very demotivating for them. And similarly, if students were engaging in an activity solely to win something else and otherwise wouldn't engage in the activity at all, that would undermine their autonomy, so their free choice behavior, and that would also therefore undermine motivation. So I think the upshot here is that competition can be good, but it has to be used carefully. And I'd be interested to hear how you use competition in the classroom, if you do, and how you mitigate those negative effects. Now, speaking of intrinsic motivation refers to doing something for the inherent satisfactions of the activity itself. So you do it because you enjoy doing it, rather than for some other reason, for example, to win a competition. So that's what intrinsic motivation is. The motivation is intrinsic to you and the activity when you're engaged in it. Your reason for doing it comes from within yourself, from those positive feelings of engaging in the activity, rather than from outside. Now, when a student does something wrong, misbehaves, we often give them time to reflect, usually in a DT, on what they did wrong. We may ask them, how does that make you feel? Are you proud of yourself? And what we're encouraging them to do there is to reflect on what we hope are the negative feelings associated with the negative behavior. And that may deter them from engaging in the behavior again. That's what we're doing. But on the flip side, when a student does something positive, do we always encourage them to reflect on the positive feelings that go along with those positive behaviors? And I don't think we do. In the hustle and bustle of school life, I think students engage in countless positive behaviors, but are rushed on to the next thing so quickly that they never get to, they may not notice at all the positive feelings that went along with the positive behavior. And so this is something I'm going to try to do from now on. When a student does something positive, for example, maybe they help me hand out the books at the start of a lesson, maybe they do it without even having to be asked, something like that. Or if I see a student be kind to another student or act in a caring way, something like that, I'm going to make a point of saying, well done, how did that make you feel? I'd like to give them just a moment before they're rushed on to doing their work or whatever it might be. I'd like to give them a moment where they can stop and look inward and focus just for a second on how those positive behaviors made them feel. And it will be a positive feeling, no doubt. And I think by doing that, by encouraging students to look inward, that will enhance intrinsic motivation to behave appropriately, to behave well, to be kind and caring, whatever it might be. Okay, last but not least, I'll do a quick mental health check-in. My mental health has been good, very good, I would say. Again, I feel I'm working hard as part of a team, a wonderful team, and we're all working hard together in pursuit of a worthwhile goal, namely educating students, children, improving their life chances. And so all that has contributed to me feeling very good in terms of my mental health. Well, that's all well and good, but if one of your basic needs suddenly goes unmet, for example, maybe you don't have time for breakfast, or maybe you're dehydrated, or maybe you haven't slept well, this is no doubt going to have a negative effect on your mental health. It certainly does with me anyway. Well, the big one for me is tiredness. If I don't get a good night's sleep, that could be an issue the following day. I just feel more stressed. And I feel like I'm not firing on all cylinders, which annoys me. I'll feel slow. So tiredness is the big one for me. Yet, bizarrely, when it comes to feeling tired, the number of hours sleep I get doesn't seem to matter as much as the way in which I wake up. So I could have gotten 8, 9, 10 hours sleep, but if in the morning my alarm drags me out of a deep, dark slumber and jolts me awake, I'll feel awful for the whole day. My head will be thick and heavy with tiredness, and my mental health will suffer as a result. I'll be grumpy, I'll feel slow, not good at all. By contrast, if I've only had 5 or 6 hours sleep, but I wake up naturally before my alarm, I can feel as fresh as a daisy. It's very strange. I've tried to mitigate this, so I have two alarms. One is a light alarm that starts to come on 40 minutes, I think, before I need to wake up, very gradually. It's meant to simulate a sunrise. I would recommend them. But if that hasn't woken me up, I do have an alarm, an audible one, that goes off on my phone at the end of that 40-minute period, just to ensure that I'm awake. But I'm thinking of turning that one off entirely, because it's that one that does the damage. It's that one that jolts me awake sometimes. And I feel that on those occasions, it would have been better for me to sleep an extra 15 minutes, even half an hour, because I do set my alarm very early and wake up naturally, rather than being jolted awake. So I'm going to try this. If I end up sleeping in an hour or two, then I might have a problem and I may have to revert to the alarm on my phone as an insurance system, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I'd be very interested to know whether other people have this experience too. If your alarm jolts you awake out of a deep, dark sleep, do you feel groggy for the rest of the day? Or is it just me? Please let me know. Okay, so this episode took around 2 hours to produce. That's about average. And I aim to produce 2 or 3 episodes a month, although I've produced a few more this month with all the stuff to do with strikes. If you think that work is worth at least the price of a coffee, £2 or £3, once a month, then please consider becoming a patron and helping me cover the cost of producing this podcast. It's not very expensive, the podcast. I think it costs about £13 a month. And I do already have 2 patrons, my mum and my old mentor. Thank you both if you're listening. But any other contributions would be greatly appreciated. The link to my Patreon, as always, is in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please spread the word in person and on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at MrBrownPod or email MrBrownPod@gmail.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review in your directory of choice. Please also consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/MrBrownPod. and helping me cover the cost of producing the podcast. Thank you, and talk again soon.